If you want to open up your Bibles, we'll be in Acts chapter 15. Acts 15 is where we're going to begin our message. The title of the message is The Invisible Hand. You know, all of us have stuff going on in our lives. Some of it's good, some of it's not so good. All of us have things that we actually enjoy about what's happening in our life. And then the flip side is the stuff that it's not going well at all. And I don't know if it's the same with you as it is with me, but I tend to focus on the negative stuff more than the positive stuff. Occupies my time more often as I'm thinking about how do I get out of this situation? How do I resolve this problem? Those are the kinds of things that keep us up at night, you know, take our sleep away, is trying to fix what's broken, what should be different. And so if you're anything like I am, we focus on the negative rather than on the positive, which is unfortunate because God is always at work, even in those negative things, to turn it around for a positive. And we need to learn how to trust Him in the process of even when we don't understand why we're going through what we're going through, even if we don't know the reason behind it, or if there's any purpose for it at all, there is God in the background. He's working. He's orchestrating things. So the ultimate end is for His glory and for our good. There was a book that was written many years ago by R.C. Sproul, a theologian, and he titled the book, The Invisible Hand. And I stole that title for this message tonight because that's really what I want us to focus on. In that book, it is all about how God is always behind the scenes, working in the circumstances of our lives, the good things, the bad things, the things that we don't understand at all. He is working through those things to an ultimate end that is going to be for our good and for God's glory. And the whole book is based upon a verse that we're all very familiar with. In fact, Nathan just made mention of it as he was closing out the worship time. Romans chapter 8, verse 28. It's a verse that many of us have quoted to our friends when they're going through a rough time. It's a means of us trying to bring some perspective and comfort in their life, and we'll tell them, hey, you know, I know it's tough right now, but the Bible tells us that all things work together for those that love God and are called according to His purpose. And then there's other times that we're on the receiving end of that. It's us that is going through the difficult times, and we have our Christian friends that are going to remind us of Romans 8, 28, and they will quote it to us. So we're familiar with that verse, we're familiar with that promise of God, but I don't think that we often really reflect upon the times that that verse, that promise, is actually fulfilled in our lives. In fact, we can go through a hard time this week, and then a few weeks from now, those negative things, God is now twisting around and bringing some great stuff out of it. But at that point, we're facing a new rough thing in our life, and we've forgotten about how God has now turned it already around for good. Well, here in Acts chapter 15, we're going to see not only one situation, we're going to see a series of situations, all of which have a negative thing that is taking place, that the Lord is going to turn around for His purpose, for His good, for the benefit of His people, and for His own glory. And if it was not for the sake that these are all connected in time, we would say that these are unrelated situations completely, but they are connected. And in each of them, we see a negative become a positive, all because God is that invisible hand in the background who is working His wonders to bring about an ultimate end that is going to bless His people and glorify Himself. So we're going to begin here in chapter 15. We're actually at the end of chapter 15, verse 36. And we will take each of these instances, four of them we're going to take a look at. We'll look at them individually, beginning in verse 36. It says, after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they are doing. Now Barnabas was determined to take with them John called Mark. But Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to do the work. Then the contention became so sharp that they parted from one another. And so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God. And he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Now, this is the beginning of what would be what we call Paul's second missionary journey. But I need to give you the background on why what is taking place is actually taking place. You see, Paul and Barnabas were both part of a church in Antioch 5 years prior. And as this church was meeting and ministering, the Spirit of God began to speak to Paul and Barnabas that he was sending them out as missionaries to bring the gospel to places of the world that had no knowledge of Christ and needed to know God, needed to understand that Christ died for their sins. And so they were going to carry the gospel to new areas. And so the church in Antioch sent these two out, and for a year they would travel around to different towns, different cities, and they would proclaim the message of the gospel in an attempt to draw people to Christ. And many of these locations, they did see people turn their lives over to faith in Christ and get saved. And if that happened, they would disciple them for a bit. They would oftentimes plant a new church in that area. And then they would go on to the next place, and this would carry on for a year. And at the end of the year, they returned to Antioch and expressed to the church all of the things that God did over the year, the good, the bad, and the ugly, because part of it was definitely blessed, and other parts of it were a struggle. But now 5 years has passed. And Paul is now thinking about all of those people that they had a chance to minister to and these new churches that they had a chance to plant. And he's wondering what's going on with them. I mean, back in that day, they didn't really have an easy time in contacting those that they knew. I mean, there was no email. There was no texting. There was no social media. And so for 5 years, he pretty much has been unconnected to these people that he ministered to 5 years previously. So he has the idea, we need to go back. We need to find out what's going on. Are they healthy? Are they growing in the Lord? Are these churches thriving? Or are they struggling? Do we need to kind of come alongside of them and get them back on track? That was what was on his heart. And he shares this with his partner from that first trip, Barnabas. And Barnabas is thinking this is a great idea. And he says, hey, we ought to also bring John Mark along with us. And Paul's response is, not on your life. We are not taking him. You see, John Mark had gone with them the first time. And sometime in the middle of that year of ministry, John Mark bailed out. He went back home. He abandoned the ministry that they were a part of. And Paul had trusted him and felt like John Mark broke that trust. We needed him, and he abandoned us at the time that we absolutely needed him. I cannot count on him. He failed us. I'm not going to risk him failing us again. Barnabas, on the other hand, is saying, yeah, but that was 5 years ago. He's not the same guy. He's grown up a little bit. We need to give him another chance. I think he is the right guy to join us in this ministry work. And so they disagreed. But it wasn't just a little disagreement. In verse 39, in my Bible, I'm reading out of the New King James Version, it calls it a contention. In the NIV version, it's translated a sharp disagreement. In fact, the word in the Greek language that it's translated contention or sharp disagreement, we actually have an English word that was drawn from that Greek word, called paroxysm, which means a violent outburst. So this was not just a couple of guys who thought differently and said, well, I think this and or I think that. These are two guys that are entrenched in their view, and Doesn't say that they're going to blows. I don't imagine that they did go to blows, but it meant that this was a hotly contested argument. They were after each other. They were entrenched in their position. They were not going to budge. The other one was absolutely wrong, and it was a violent outburst type of an argument. You guys know what I'm talking about. So I would imagine, you know, if there were others that were around while they were hashing this out, they were like, whoa, what's going on? These are some of the church leaders. These are missionaries. These guys should know better. Why are they acting like this? This is something that should not happen between two brothers in the Lord, and yet they are really having it out. So who is right? Was Paul right or was Barnabas right? Well, we need to understand that both of these guys had very, very different personalities. They were ministering together and had ministered together, but they were not the same types of people. Paul was very much an A-type personality. He was a go-getter. He was the kind of guy that made plans and was going to make sure that those plans were carried out. He was surrounding himself with people that were going to help him accomplish those types of plans. And in his mind, John Mark had absolutely failed, and I'm not going to take another chance that he's going to fail us again. I'm going to make sure that the people that are going to be included in this venture are the right people, and he's not the right guy. Barnabas, on the other hand, was more of the nurturer, the encourager. He's the one that comes alongside of people that might be struggling, and he's going to coach them. He's going to direct them. He's going to help them along so that they can get back on track. That was kind of his personality. In fact, Barnabas isn't even really his birth-given name. We find back in Acts chapter 4 that his name was Joseph, but everybody called him Barnabas. Why? Because Barnabas was a term that meant encourager. So that was what he was known for, that he was the guy that comes alongside of you and he's going to boost you up when you're down. He's going to help redirect you when, you know, you don't know what to do or when you're falling short. That was his personality. So two very different personalities have a different response to this guy. Paul's saying, I'm not giving him another chance. I'm not going to risk that failure. Barnabas saying, I think absolutely we need to take him. And I don't think that either of them were wrong. I think both of them had the purpose of God in their heart and in their mind. They were just coming at it from very different perspectives because they were very different people. But any way we look at it, it's an ugly situation. It's something that, you know, is very, you know, troublesome that two substantial men of God cannot get along and are literally going to part ways right here. Because Barnabas is going to take John Mark, and they're going to go in one direction. And Paul is going to find a new sidekick by the name of Silas, and they are going to go in another direction. And we can look at this and say, wow, that is so unfortunate. That should never have happened. This is just a bad deal. But if we look at the results of what happened, we might come up with a different response. You see, because now there's not just one missionary team, there's now two missionary teams. Paul and Silas are going to go back to the places that they had visited previously. Barnabas is going to take John Mark to the island of Cyprus to do some ministry there. And now, rather than one team going out, there's now two teams going out. But that's not even where the positives end. You see, the investment that Barnabas put into John Mark is going to turn out to be a very good investment. Because John Mark is going to make a turnaround. In fact, even the Apostle Paul had to acknowledge that later, because in 2 Timothy chapter 4, in verse 11, Paul later would mention John Mark in that message, saying that he was valuable to the ministry. Even to Paul's ministry at that point in time, John Mark had made himself valuable. Which means the fact that Barnabas was willing to give him a second chance was the right decision to make for Barnabas to invest in him, because it would be part of John Mark's turnaround. In fact, it's even more than that, because we have a gospel named Mark, because John Mark was the author of that gospel. And God would use this young man who had been a failure, had abandoned his post, would later use him to write the message of Christ that has been read by millions of people over the centuries, and many have been led to Christ through that influence. You see, sometimes bad things happen, even in relationships that we have. Some of us might have serious conflicts going on in our lives right now with someone that we just can't get along with. Sometimes we can think, wow, there's nothing ever good that's going to come out of this. But the invisible hand of God is oftentimes working where we don't see that He is working. And He's going to bring around good from what looks really bad right now. Back in my younger ministry days, I was a youth pastor down in San Diego. And I was a high school pastor. I had a high school ministry of about 25, 30 kids. And weekly, we would get together for Bible studies. We would do retreats. We, you know, went on various trips and so forth and so on. And I had one young guy invited a friend. And this friend's name was Matt. Matt showed up to our youth group by invitation. And Matt was kind of a larger-than-life type of a guy. He had a big personality, which was very attractive to the ladies in the group. And Matt was very attracted to the ladies as well. So he was getting a lot of attention from them. He was paying them a lot of attention. And as the youth pastor, that was a problem. Because oftentimes, the attention wasn't where it ought to be. Because I would find Matt paying too much attention to one of the girls. And he was asking some of them on dates. And that would take place, and then it would end really badly, and there would be a broken heart, and there would be the gossip chain, and then he would be on showing interest to somebody else. And I was in a place where I just wanted Matt to go away. I remember one occasion, I was in my car, I was going about town, and I was stopped at a red light. And I noticed in another part of the intersection, there was this old, beat-up, yellow Ford Fiesta that looked like it came out of a junkyard. That was Matt's car. I recognized it. And I looked through the windshield, and sure enough, there was Matt in the driver's seat, and he's got a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And every negative thought just came flooding through my head about this guy. And I remember praying, Lord, I know that you are the good shepherd, and I know that you will leave the 99, you will go after the one. But did you ever look at the 99 and see one of them and wish that they would wander off and never come back? Because in that moment, that is how I felt. I just wanted Matt to go away, and I wanted him never to come back. Because he was, in my mind, just a problem that was never going to be fixed unless it disappeared. Well, Matt didn't go away. And in the following weeks, actually, in the next month or two, I noticed that there was a change that was taking place. He was actually getting more interested in the Bible studies that we were having. He was still interested in the girls, but there was an interest in the Bible and in God. And so at one point, I had a conversation with him. I said, Matt, you know, would you be interested in meeting with me on a weekly basis, and we'll do a little discipleship? And I didn't know whether he would be interested in that or not, but he said yes. And so we got together. And I remember on that first occasion that we sat down together, I said, Matt, you have a problem. You have a girl problem. You pay way too much attention to them. And it's not only a problem for you, you're creating a problem for them. And so if we're going to do this discipleship, I'm going to ask something of you. I'm going to ask you to make a commitment that for 6 months you will not date any girl, whether in our group, out of our group, you're just not going to engage with women. You're not going to spend time with them. You're not going to flirt with them. They are off limits for 6 months so that you can focus on growing in a relationship with Christ. Would you agree to that? He thought about it for a second. He said, "You're on. I will do that." And believe it or not, he did. He stopped flirting with the girls. He avoided conversations with them. Didn't ask any of them out. And he met with me on a weekly basis, and we did Bible study. And when that 6 months was over, I fully anticipated he was counting down the days, but it turns out he wasn't counting down the days. At the end of the 6 months, he didn't immediately jump into dating girls again. He continued to stay single and focus on Jesus. You know, today, Matt is a senior pastor of a church in San Diego, California. I would have never thunk in a million years that that would have happened, coming out of that beat-up yellow Ford Fiesta. But see, God was working behind the scenes in ways that I could have never realized. And a guy that I was so ready to write him off completely, God was not writing him off. God had a purpose and a plan. You know, sometimes we write people off. There are people in our life that we just think, you know, they're hopeless. It's never going to change. They're more of a problem than it's worth. And I wish they would just go away. But you never know what God has in store. Here was a conflict that was taking place between two believers over a young man who had failed. But God had a plan for John Mark's life. He was going to use John Mark, even to the point where the apostle would have to acknowledge that he's not who he used to be. He's a changed man, and he's actually useful for me in the ministry. God taking a bad situation and turning it around for good. But now look what happens in chapter 16, verse 1. Then he came to Derbe. The he is the Apostle Paul. So we're not going to be following Barnabas and John Mark as they go to Cyprus. We're going to follow Paul and Silas as they go on Paul's second missionary journey. Then he came to Derbe and Lystra, and behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was Greek. He was well spoken of by the brethren who were in Lystra and Iconium, and Paul wanted to have him go on with him. And he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region, for they all knew that his father was Greek. And as they went through the cities, they delivered them the decrees to keep, which were determined by the apostles and elders at Jerusalem. Verse 5, so the churches were strengthened in faith and increased in number daily. Now, Paul is in Lystra, which was a place that he had gone the first time on his missionary journey 5 years prior. And I have to tell you that that first visit to Lystra was forgettable because it did not go very well at all. Although initially it looked like the people were responding, in the end, the whole town turned their back on Paul and Barnabas. And that is the place, Lystra was the place, you might remember the story, where Paul was stoned by the city people to the point where they thought he was dead. They dragged his body out of the town. That's a way to tell somebody, we don't want you here. Well, Paul recovered from that. We're not even really sure if he actually died and God brought him back to life or whether he was just mostly dead and revived. But I think the conclusion would be ministry did not go that great in Lystra. That was a failed attempt to bring the gospel to people who were not just not interested, they were really not interested. And so for the last 5 years, Paul probably said, well, you know, in reflecting upon that first missionary journey, things did not go good at all in Lystra. But now he's back at Lystra. And when he gets back, he runs into Timothy. Now, who was Timothy? Well, it tells us he is a disciple, and that he is the son of a woman who believed. But Paul would later call Timothy his son in the faith, which is very likely a way to say that Paul had actually led Timothy to faith in Christ, which almost assuredly would have happened on that first missionary journey. So though on the outward it looked like at the time that that ministry in Lystra was a complete disaster, that there wasn't really anything good that came out of it, now 5 years later, he is seeing Timothy again. Now he's 5 years more mature in the Lord, so much so that the people are actually commending him to Paul, and Paul chooses Timothy to join them in their ministry work. So Timothy now becomes part of the team. But 5 years ago, it seemed like it was of no fruit whatsoever, that that was a complete disaster. But now Paul is actually seeing that fruit did come out of that ministry. It might not have been abundant fruit at the time, but it was good fruit. And sometimes we are looking for an abundance of fruit out of our ministry or our lives. And we don't see it in abundance, but maybe the fruit that is there is quality, high quality. Timothy, no doubt, was high quality. He later himself would become a pastor. And Paul would write two letters to him. 1 and 2 Timothy were written by Paul to this young pastor, encouraging him in his ministry. But what looked like a disaster up front turned out to actually be effective. In fact, if you look again at verse 5, it says, "So the churches were strengthened in faith and increased in number daily." What began 5 years ago that might have seemed like minuscule success is now bearing much fruit because the churches are growing in that area. So what began as maybe a fruitless or at least very little fruit endeavor turns out to be very fruitful in the end. Again, God's hand behind the scenes working. You know, I grew up in a family that I consider it a non-Christian upbringing, although there was some residue of Christianity. I'll explain a little bit. My parents both were raised in Christian homes and were actually, as young adults, they were involved in ministry. But when they got married and they had me and my siblings, that became something that just kind of faded out. I do have recollections as a young boy of being taken to church, but it was not a regular thing. It was just kind of an infrequent thing, and I hated it. It would be the kind of a thing that on a Sunday morning, my mom would come in my room to wake me up to tell me, "Get ready, we are going to go to church today." And I would get so upset, I'd run in the bathroom, I'd lock the door, and vow, "I'm never coming out until you say I don't have to go." And I lost every one of those battles and had to go. I just didn't, it wasn't important to me. It wasn't regular enough in our life to make it important to me. To me, it was taking a valuable day off away from me. I mean, I was having to go to kindergarten, you know, Monday through Friday. Saturday and Sunday were my days, and I wanted to be with my friends. I wanted to ride bikes. I wanted to build forts. I wanted to play with G.I. Joes. I did not want to go to church. So when it faded out of our lives, I was thrilled. By the time I was about 8 years old, we weren't going to church at all, and I was fine with that. But I had a grandma, I called her Nana, that was a devout Christian. She loved the Lord. And I know that she was a praying grandma. And here I am, this young kid who has no interest in God whatsoever. I mean, I liked playing in the dirt. I liked riding bikes. I liked chasing lizards. When I got into my teens, my whole ambition in life was to be a rock star. That's where I was headed. I was going to play before millions of screaming girls, all screaming my name. That's where my mind was focused. But I had a praying Nana. And my praying Nana always gave me gifts that were based on the Bible. I remember as a kid getting Jesus coloring books and many similar things. It seemed like every birthday, every Easter, every Christmas, I was going to get something from Nana that had a Christian vibe to it. And I was taught by my parents, you know, to be very polite, you know, smile, say thank you. You can do whatever you want with it after Nana is gone, but you're going to show your respect. And so I learned that. When I was 9 years old for Christmas, she brought a gift, and I opened that gift, hoping for the first time that it was going to be like a toy or something super fun. It was my very first Bible. It was a children's living Bible. And I did what I was supposed to do. I smiled, I hugged her, I told her thank you. And then when she was gone, I stuck that Bible in the farthest reaches of my closet and I forgot about it. I never even opened the thing. When I was 15 years old, my Nana died. And I was still that rock and roll, lizard chasing, Jesus, not hating, but completely uninterested when she passed away. I gave my life to the Lord the following year when I was 16. Because a high school buddy of mine gave his life to Christ, and he began talking to me about Jesus. And that's when God softened my heart, opened my eyes, and I realized that's what I needed in my life. And as a 16-year-old, I gave my life to Christ. But my Nana, she never saw that. She prayed for me, but never saw it. Now, I would imagine that those that are in heaven are aware, maybe they're not, but I would imagine that they're aware of what's going on down here. But I've prayed multiple times that if my Nana doesn't know, that the Lord would tell her, hey, you remember your grandson? Well, all those prayers I answer because he is now following after me. You know, sometimes we invest ourselves in our family, we invest ourselves in our friends. We don't see any results of that. In fact, we find that their hearts are getting harder, they're getting more distant, they get angry when you even bring it up. And we can be of the mindset that this is just not going to happen. They are totally resistant. They are lost, they're going to stay lost. God is still at work behind the scenes. Those seeds that you plant, the Spirit of God is nurturing those seeds. So that one day that person that you love may have their eyes open, their heart softened, and receive Christ. It may look bad right now. It might look bad for some time to come. In fact, you may not even see it before your life is over. But just know this, that God and His invisible hand is working behind the scenes because of your prayers and because of your investment in that person's life to show them the love of God and an example of what a Christian really is. And then it goes on in verse 6. Now when they had gone through Phrygia and the region of Galatia, they were forbidden by the Holy Spirit to preach the word in Asia. And after they had come to Mysia, they tried to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit did not permit them. So passing by Mysia, they came down to Troas. And a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia stood and pleaded with him, saying, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." Now, after he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go to Macedonia, concluding that the Lord had called us to preach the gospel to them. Now, in this situation, Paul has ambition to go to certain locations. You know, he's planning out this missionary journey. You know, they are looking at where are we going next? And so he makes a plan. He has an idea. He wants to go to Asia Minor. But it tells us that the Holy Spirit prevented that from happening. So Paul shifts gears. He makes another plan. Instead of going south to Asia. He's going to go north to Bithynia. So he begins a plot and plan, and then the Spirit of God shuts that down too. And so he's making plans that God intervenes and closes the door. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. I would say it probably has. That you start making plans for your life, you're making a decision, you think your life is going in a particular direction, and then the door closes. So you make a plan B, and you start heading in that direction, thinking, okay, well, that didn't work out. Maybe this will work out, and then that door closes too. That could be very frustrating. And yet it happens to us quite a bit in our life because we are people that like to make plans. You know, maybe we got a career choice, something we think we really want to do. So we start planning. We start going to school. We start working our way towards that plan, and then somehow that door gets closed in our face. You're in a relationship. You think this relationship is headed towards marriage. You think this is the one. And then that door gets slammed in your face. And you're wondering what in the world is going on. And we can find ourselves simply staring at the door that has been closed, and we are grieving and we are weeping because that was the plan. And now the plan is not going to happen. And our hearts are broken. Our lives are crushed. And we can oftentimes find ourselves just sitting, staring at the closed door, grieving for a long time because it's what we wanted and it's not going to happen. And so there we sit, hoping that maybe that door might open. We jiggle the handle to see if it's unlocked, and we weep. Not realizing that when God closes a door, it means He's going to open another. But we're not looking for another because we're fixed on the closed door. We need to be people that if God closes a door, we may go through a time of grief because it was what we wanted. But God's ways are better than our ways. And the ultimate end that He sees, we don't see. But if we can trust Him enough to know that if He closes a door, that's not a good door for us to go through. And if He opens a door that maybe we didn't anticipate, that we ought to follow His lead and not try and make up our own plans or break down doors that should remain closed. Now, how was this door being closed? It simply is telling us that the Spirit prevented them, would not permit them. Now, there are a lot of ways that the Spirit could do that in our life. You know, sometimes it's, you know, inwardly, we just sense that God is saying no. We've got to listen to that voice. Other times it's more circumstances. It's something that is happening on the outside of us that we would have plowed through, but something is now preventing us. We can't. And so that door has now been shut by circumstances. In Paul's case, I really think it was probably an illness that he had because we know that Paul dealt with illnesses. At the time that this is actually happening, Paul was in the region of Galatia. And later on, he would write to the church of Galatia in Galatians 4:13, saying, "You know, because of physical infirmity, I preached the gospel to you at first." Which is a good indication that the reason that he went to Galatia in the first place was because he had some sickness that resulted in him going to Galatia. But evidently he had other plans. He wanted to go somewhere else, but ended up there because of his illness. It's interesting, too, that here in this passage, in verse 10, by the way, Luke is the author of the book of Acts. Luke is the one that has been writing this whole story. But up to now, he has been using certain pronouns. He has been using they, them, but in a much different way than you're thinking right now. He's been using they, them because he wasn't part of the team. Luke was not, he was writing about what they were doing, where they were going, the ministry that was happening. But you'll notice in verse 10, he switches from they to we. Now, after he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go to Macedonia, which means that this is the point in time that Luke joined the missionary team. Do you guys remember what Luke did for a living? He was a doctor, which is another indicator that maybe what the Holy Spirit was doing in closing the doors was afflicting Paul with illness that prevented. Now, those of you that face illness and are maybe dealing with illness in your life right now, we always see that as an absolute barrier. Sometimes it's a redirection. In Paul's case, if it was in fact his illness, that was the Spirit's way of saying, that's not where I want you to go. That's not the direction I'm leading you. And then God gave him the open door. In the middle of the night, he has this dream, and in this dream, he sees a man from Macedonia, and the man from Macedonia says, we need you over here. We need you to come help us. So Paul wakes up realizing that that's how God is directing him. He's closed doors. I wanted to go north. I couldn't go north. I wanted to go south. I couldn't go south. And now God has shown me what he wants me to do. He wants me to go to Macedonia. God will redirect us, and we often see the redirection as a negative. I'm being shut down. Doors are slamming in my face. I'm not getting to do what I wanted to do. I made plans, and my plans have just fallen apart. But if God is shutting something down, it isn't because he has given up on you. It's because he is redirecting your life somewhere else, where his blessing is, where he is going to use you, where he wants you to be. And that's what happened. God shut doors, but he opened one. And that door was to Macedonia. And so that's where they went. They went to Macedonia, and one of the cities that they went to there was the city of Philippi. And when they got to Philippi, they began to proclaim the gospel. There were some people that were giving their lives to the Lord, but then they hit a snag. Because there was a young lady that was there that was a fortune teller. And she was owned by the men that were profiting from her fortune telling. And Paul realized that she was possessed by a demon, and so he prayed, and she was delivered from that demon possession, which took away her ability to fortune tell. So the men that owned her realized that their financial windfall had just dried up, and they were mad. So they stirred up the people in the city to be against Paul and Silas. Notice what it says in verse 20. And they brought them to the magistrates and said, these men, being Jews, exceedingly trouble our city, and they teach customs which are not lawful for us, being Romans, to receive or observe. Then the multitude rose up together against them, and the magistrates tore off their clothes and commanded them to be beaten with rods. And when they had laid many stripes on them, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to keep them securely. Having received such a charge, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. So I want you to notice this, is that they are now doing what God wanted them to do. They're moving in the direction that God wanted them to go. God wanted them to go to Macedonia. They're now in the region of Macedonia. And what happens there? They're expecting blessing. When you follow the Lord's lead, God blesses you. Suddenly, you know, the goodness is supposed to come into your life when you are in the center of God's will. Instead, all the wheels fell off the wagon. They are persecuted. They are lied about. They have the tar beaten out of them. They are thrown into an inner prison, have their feet in the stocks. And it was all in the middle of doing what God told them to do, going where God told them to go. Now, that's not what we expect. We expect, follow the Lord, be blessed. It's when you disobey the Lord that everything collapses. But here's a situation where they are actually in the center of God's will and are suffering for it. And that messes with us because that's not what we expect, and we think something is wrong. And we actually oftentimes get angry at God. But I want you to see what their reaction was in verse 25. But at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. They're not yelling and screaming. They're not angry at God. They're actually praising God. They're singing His praises there in the prison cell. I mean, they have lacerations on their body that the blood is probably still coagulating. They've got welts that are still swelling and beginning to turn purple. But there they are praising God in the midst, and we think to ourselves, how could they possibly do that? I think in part we need to see what God has been doing in Paul's life in just the passages that we've been looking at. Because in each one of these things, there were bad things that were happening. But in each one, God is turning it around for good. So now Paul is in a new bad situation, but he's seeing the pattern. God's hand is still upon us. I don't know what God is doing. I don't know why He has allowed this to happen. But I know that He has led me here. And I know that He has allowed me to be beaten up. And now I'm sitting in a prison cell. I have nothing else to do but to trust that He has a purpose and a plan for this. Even this. And so rather than complaining and moaning and groaning, he trusts God and he sings God's praises. And you guys probably know the story. This is where in the middle of the night, an earthquake happens and the prison doors fly open so that they are able to depart. And the jailer, the guard that is there, waking up because of the earthquake, sees the doors open, assumes that all of the prisoners have escaped, and so he draws his sword to commit suicide. And Paul comes out and says, "Don't do that. We're all still here." And that jailer falls at the feet of the Apostle Paul and says, "Sir, what must I do to be saved?" And that night, that jailer and his entire household sat and heard Paul preach the gospel, and they all gave their lives to Christ, which was God's intent for allowing the suffering in Paul's life to happen. Now, none of us like to suffer, but if we are going to suffer, at least let there be a purpose for it. But honestly, many of us suffer not seeing any purpose, not understanding why. But you know, because of who God is, because He is good, and because He works even the bad things around for good, we can too trust, like Paul and Silas did, in the midst of the hardship, to know that we don't know exactly how God's going to turn this around, but we do know that He is going to turn this around. So if you're suffering today, maybe you're even in the very center of God's will. Just know that the suffering is not in vain. God has a plan and a purpose. He will turn it around for good. And He did in this situation because an entire family got saved. So we look at each of these stories, and every one of them is different than the others, but they are all weaved together, showing how God in bad circumstances is working behind the scenes to turn it around for our good and for His glory. So I don't know what you're facing today, but I would imagine you've got some bad stuff going on in your life. But if you just simply focus on all of that bad stuff and aren't looking for the invisible hand of God behind the scenes, you may miss it. God is faithful. He has not abandoned you. He is working. You may see it in this lifetime turned around for good. You may not see it until you are in the kingdom of heaven and God is able to open your eyes to every time in your life when you thought that no good could ever come from this. He will point out the very things that He was doing to bring good out of it. Why? Because that is the kind of God that He is. He works all things together for good. Amen?